Hej och varmt välkomna till Placera-podden. Idag ska vi få lära oss mer om tillväxtmarknader. Med oss i studien är ingen mindre än Emre Akçakmak från East Capital. Very nice to have you in our studio, Emre.
Thank you, Carl. Good to be here.
You're based in Dubai and you're head of Frontier Markets at East Capital.
Right.
And you've been at East Capital for quite some time now.
18 years to be exact.
Yeah, it's quite a while.
Long time.
But what's your background?
My background is that I'm born in Turkey, came to Sweden about 20 years ago, studied at Stockholm School of Economics. Then I wanted to stay in Sweden. I liked it in here. I was looking for something to do with Turkey, and East Capital was looking for an analyst covering its Turkish investment. So it was love at first sight. And I started then back in 2006 along with the Turkish fund of East Capital. And I stayed on up until 2016, responsible for investments in Turkey. Switched to Frontier Markets at the time about 10 years ago. And since 2016, I've been working out of Dubai, but coming back and forth to Stockholm.
When you look at global frontier markets at the moment, what do you see then?
So let's first define what frontier markets are, because when we talk about developed markets, everybody knows it's the US, it's Europe, it's Japan. When we talk about emerging markets, you would immediately understand I'm talking about China, India, and all other, you know, 20-something emerging markets. So let's first start with the definition of frontier markets. These markets are essentially faster-growing emerging markets, but they are so small that they are not taking their part in emerging market indices. So they are typically overlooked. An average investor wouldn't invest too much in frontier markets because sometimes they simply don't know about them. Sometimes there are simply no good products to be investing in these markets. But what are these markets? These markets include in Asia, Vietnam and the Philippines, fast growing markets with young populations, you know, 6-7% GDP growth a year. Then you got Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, still very young and populous markets. Then in the Middle East, you have Saudi Arabia, UAE, Kuwait, Egypt. In Africa, pretty much all markets will be considered as small emerging markets or frontier markets. The largest ones would be Nigeria and Kenya. Then you got Morocco and some other smaller markets. In Eastern Europe, Romania, Slovenia. Then you have Kazakhstan and some Latin American markets, including Peru and Argentina. But this is all bits and pieces, all these smaller markets, which are typically overlooked and underinvested by an average investor. So that's the definition and the outlook. I think in short, I think what's common among these markets is that these are really underdeveloped compared to the rest of the world, compared to developed markets or emerging markets in terms of their financial market infrastructure, equity markets, but they are all moving in the right direction and growing significantly faster than their peers. That's what's common among all these markets.
Are there any of these frontier markets that you prefer at the moment?
Well, at the moment, I can tell you about Asian frontier markets, Middle Eastern frontier markets in general, but we are very much of stock pickers. I think picking the right investment, making the right investment in the right place is more important than picking the right markets. But in general, of course, the markets we are investing in would be those which would be growing by 47% on average. If you have GDP growth, maybe in the short term, it doesn't translate into superior equity returns. Look at the US market now. US is not growing by 5%, but it's been the best performing market. If you take actually all emerging markets, all developed markets over the last 10 years, per annum, S&P has been going up by 10.5% annual return. And when you look at all other markets, they've been growing by 5-6%. So it's been an extraordinary period, but that was driven by stocks. That wasn't driven by the GDP growth or of the US or anything. And that was also the currency in the equation. When you look at our markets, we'll be looking for fast growth. I think nominal GDP growth also matters. But from different perspectives, you have the likes of, again, Vietnam and the Philippines growing by 6-7%. This is driven by structural growth. This is not going to change overnight. You know, when we talk about these markets, we'll most likely be talking about similar growth rates in the next 3-5 years as well. Young populations are there, reform processes are there. But on top of that, you have a bit slower growth in the Middle East, but we are talking still about 4-5% growth. Look at Saudi Arabia, all the reforms that they are coming up with. In the UAE, there is clear willingness to diversify the economy. Egypt is coming back. Africa is improving compared to past few years. So you have abundance of opportunities. But I don't like to talk about individual markets at a specific point in time because things change. You know, sometimes you have a market that's moving in the right direction, then it falls, then you go to the other market, better opportunities, better stocks. But the point about frontier markets is that it's abundance of opportunities, and sometimes things don't work, then you can move, always move on to the next exciting opportunity.
Mm. If you look at East Capital Global Frontier Markets Fund, it's up almost 27% this year. Mm-hmm. What has been driving the growth this year?
I think we are in a very positive cycle for these markets. If we go back a little bit, a few years back, up until COVID, we had quite a few issues in many of these markets, not only frontier markets, but emerging markets and even developed markets. 10 years ago, we would be talking about Italy, Spain, and Greece. So all markets, even if they are developed markets, they have their own cycles, own issues, and there's always a time that they need to address these issues. When you look at frontier markets, being smaller markets, they are typically in need of external financing compared to maybe developed markets or some of the emerging markets. So these issues have been going on. They had some currency misalignment, currencies were overvalued. Inflation had been low, but if you see a currency depreciation, you typically see increased inflation. When COVID came, I think it was the end of the game for many of these markets. They couldn't kick the can down the road anymore. They needed to address these issues. Take Sri Lanka, for instance. It was a market under stress for many, many years. Nothing happened, because if nothing happens, nothing happens. You know, if there is no push from outside world or there is no scarcity of liquidity, these markets can go on forever. Look at Lebanon. For 15 years, everyone expected Lebanon to default. Nothing happened. But when you go that to that last extra mile, you can't go any further. And the market, then the economy collapsed eventually. Sri Lanka was the same. Why did that happen? Because COVID was such a strong wind against these markets that they had to address the issues. There were defaults. There were some down cycles in economies. Pakistan saw a lot of stress. Some other markets saw a lot of stress, but they eventually had to address these issues. They saw significant depreciation in currencies or devaluations in some cases, but eventually policymakers had to do something about that. Starting from last year, you asked me about this year's performance, but that's important to put things into perspective. Starting from last year, we saw economic rebalancing taking place in these many markets. Risk appetite has been increasing. US has been performing really well, developed markets performing well. Emerging markets, except for China, were performing really well. It usually goes unnoticed. When you look at emerging markets, people say they are doing very poorly. It's true if you look from an index perspective, they are doing poorly. But if you exclude China, for instance, 2023, last year was a great year for emerging markets. It was one of best years in terms of performance of markets, in terms of the balance of performance. You had many markets performing last year. So that was one indicator. Frontier markets had a similar year. In the first half, they still had their challenges. But starting from the second half, you saw this significant performance, significant inflows, change of mood. I think market mood is very important as well. Locals are important in these markets for the stock markets. Then we had this positive cycle, both in economies and on the stock market front. If you look at market performance, not only this year, but let's go back 1 year, starting from second half of last year and also year-to-date performance, when you look at top 10 markets globally, these markets would include Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Sri Lanka, Turkey, Argentina, Romania, Slovenia. And these markets, you wouldn't think they would be the best markets, but I'm not talking about 10%, 20% performance. I'm talking about 30 to 50% performance in US dollar terms. So the bottom line is that there was stress, policymakers not addressing that, but then it was significant headwinds, significant stress. They couldn't go on forever. Some of them failed. Some of them failed and started to recover. And starting from last year, economies are now on an upcycle with a lot of positive developments taking place.
But you shouldn't expect this kind of growth in the equity markets going forward, or?
It's difficult to tell, but I think there is a significant rebound component in that as well. If something, when you know simple maths, if something goes down by 50%, you go from 100 to 50. To recover back to similar levels, you go from 50 to 100, that's 100% return.
Yeah.
So coming from a low base, numbers always look very handsome.
Yeah.
But to continue with that kind of performance, it becomes more difficult. But going forward, I think we can expect for many of these markets to have normalized performance, but still quite decent performance is what we expect.
What specific criteria do you use when selecting investments in frontier markets?
This is the most, I don't know about all the rest of the questions and all sorts of discussions, but that's the most important question for any portfolio manager. And unfortunately, whenever I hear this question and I hear the answer, it's always the same. You want to invest with good management, good businesses, high quality companies. I haven't heard too many long-term portfolio managers talking about investing in poorly managed companies, in bad businesses, poor returns, expensive companies. So I'm not going to repeat that message. I think we all know what kind of companies or qualities we'll be looking for. But the angle I want to add to that discussion is that I think there is little talk about portfolio construction. We can always, I mean, we have been investing throughout our history of frontier markets, probably over 100 companies, maybe 120 companies, include all other investors, investments that I've been also responsible for in Turkey or in different parts of the world, this would be probably going up to more than 200. And I can always cherry pick one or two good investments and present that. But that's just one investment, right? Criteria for one investment. You can take 1% position, think about your private portfolios. 1% position in a high conviction idea, fantastic company, or you can take 10% or 20%. I think we should take everything, having talked about this generally accepted criteria, let's say. It's important to have the right positioning. And for us, I think that's also underrated, that having survival instincts for a long-term investor is extremely important. We can always talk about individual companies, but we all have to survive in the long term. We all need to run away from trouble. That is important. Charlie Munger, I like his saying that he says, all I want to know is where I'm going to die, so I'll never go there. Initially, I didn't understand. It didn't sound like a fancy quote. But when you think about it, really, he was talking about running away from troubles. Because if only we can run away from troubles, and that comes with personal qualities, I think. It's not about your Excel sheet. It's not about your multiples or all sorts of calculations. How do we run away from trouble? I think being a bit risk averse doesn't hurt, especially in our markets. But when you face with corporate scandals, have you seen any corporate scandal that the market didn't react? It's very rare. I mean,
no.
You would see if something happens in developed world as well, not only about frontier markets. Stocks would react going down by 20%, 30%, 50%.
And these scandals, happens, do they happen more in frontier markets?
Not necessarily more. That's a bit surprising. I don't know. It sounds very counterintuitive. You would think this is a big jungle, so many corporate scandals and so on. But maybe it's because they are very focused on improving their financial markets. Because if something like that happens, that market is done for the following 10 years. And they need to be more careful than developed markets. So checks and balances, I can't tell you in a systemic way they are better. But I think people who are involved are probably a bit more focused, so it doesn't happen. But we don't know. My point about corporate scandals is, number one, it's not as bad as one might think. And we haven't seen so many corporate scandals. But whenever something like that is boiling, of course, survival instincts are very important. We need to run away from trouble. We need to survive. But number two, the reason why this big reaction is happening wherever you go in the world is because corporate scandals are very difficult to predict. So whatever I tell you now about investment criteria, we invest with good management and so on, but it's that management, which you think is great, is taking this bad behavior that leads to corporate governance scandals. It's very difficult to foresee. This is what I mean, we need to be realistic. I can't tell you that, yes, we do our work. We have our ESG work. We have our ESG scorecards. We analyze companies. We meet with the managements. We travel to these countries and companies. We do everything we can. But we also need to accept that sometimes it's unavoidable, as confirmed by market reaction. Because if everyone knew about it, there wouldn't have been that kind of market reaction. Okay, this company is collapsing. We knew about that. So there's no stock price reaction. That never happens. So that's quite important. And portfolio construction, again, individual investments are important, but we need to also take everything with the portfolio in mind. You can take a great company having 1% of your portfolio, it doesn't contribute to any return. So we need to maximize the returns. A great company should have a large weight, but we also need to have a portfolio view that with so many moving parts, especially in frontier markets with low correlations among each other, we also need to take it as a melting pot, you know, that we take everything and we diversify away the risks. And one other, maybe it's a long answer to your short question.
No problem.
But one other aspect about investment, investing in frontier markets is that risk is diversified by its nature, by the nature of these markets. Because think about developed markets. What are they? They are the US, Europe, accounting for 80% of your typical index and typical fund. So when you invest in France, you know that it's high correlations to Germany. You know that correlations high to Sweden, and Sweden between Norway and Finland and so on. You have high correlations, so you don't get the diversification benefits. They are individually less volatile, but there's almost no diversification benefits. If you invest in emerging markets, you have still high correlations. It's 80%, 90% concentrated in Asia, but they are more volatile. So you get some diversification benefits, but they are more volatile. The most counterintuitive point about frontier markets is that they are not as volatile as you might think. And on top of that, correlations among these markets is so low that you get full benefits of diversification. And as an outcome, if you analyze last 10 years, look at standard deviation of indices, take MSCI indices as the benchmark. Emerging markets are more volatile than developed markets, but frontier markets are less. I mean, you have developed markets, emerging markets, they are volatile. Frontier markets are less volatile than emerging markets because you get full benefits of diversification. That's very counterintuitive because you might think frontier markets are all over the place, crazy volatility. But when you take everything together, they are less volatile 10 out of 10 years compared to emerging markets, 8 out of 10 years compared to developed markets. So you have also certain room to maneuver among all these different risks.
When you find this great company, this cheap great company in one emerging market, isn't it easy to get trapped in so-called value traps in frontier markets? Or?
Value traps are everywhere.
They're everywhere, yeah.
Talk to some Alibaba investor or some Meta investor 2-3 years ago. So no, I think value traps are personally because, you know, funds and strategies reflect the personality of the portfolio manager. Some years ago, I was in a wine tasting session. The expert was talking about different wines and he was telling that, okay, I can understand taking a sip if the producer of this wine was happy or upset during that spring, or he was coming up with these views that it reflects the personality. I didn't understand it then, but really, if you look at different funds, different portfolios, you see that they grow by the personalities, by qualities of the manager and of the team and of the company. It's in the DNAs. So it very much reflects. What do our products reflect at East Capital and in the responsibilities that I have? I think I personally find value traps very difficult to avoid because you are always attracted by that 6x, 7x PE. And sometimes you have the fallen angels. You have investors darling trading at 20-25x earnings. All great. Everyone is buying into that stock. Stock is performing. And then something happens. It's coming down. And again, think about Alibaba. I think it's always easy for everyone to relate to this kind of a stock. when it was 20, 25 times earnings, everyone was stepping on each other to buy that stock. And then it starts going down to 20. At 15, it becomes attractive. Oh, it's so cheap because it used to be 20, 25 times. Then it goes to 14, 12, 10, 8, 9. And you don't know when the turning point is. And every time it becomes more attractive. So value traps, I think there is a reason for calling them the value traps. Difficult to identify the fallen angels, but there is always, almost always, let's say, unless the company is completely on the wrong track, there's usually the turning points. And when these turning points, I mean, our task is to address turning points for these kind of value traps. And sometimes it's also asymmetrical risk return, you know, asymmetrical return profile. A stock might remain at, really, in our world, 4 times price to earnings, which is nothing, you know, from a valuation perspective. And it remains for 2-3 years and you get a bit tired of it. But on the fourth year, it might triple. So we have these kind of examples as well. So it's very difficult to make a general characteristic of a value trap. It takes a while, but we need to, I mean, this is one of our tasks along with the survival instinct. We need to identify what's a value trap and what's a stock that is, you know, ready to jump from those levels.
I think in the case of Alibaba, it's a lot of China in itself. No, it's uninvestable. If Alibaba would have been based in India, for instance, it would probably not have been a value trap. I'm just guessing now, but...
Difficult to say, yes, but there's a lot of China risk or perceived China risk, let's call it that way. But there is a component of significant slowdown in growth. That's a real risk. That's not about China. If it was in India, and not growing or growing by 3% a year, that will be still treated in the same way. But Indian stocks might also turn into value traps at some point because we all have this perception of fantastic growth. Companies are delivering 20% earnings growth every year. And the first time that earnings growth goes down to 10%, we'll all be thinking, and I don't know if it happens in 5 years, 10 years, or if it ever happens, it will happen at some point. But it will take a while for investors to realize that that is, you know, here to stay, and you don't go from 10% to 20%. You might go from 10 to 5. So it's a process, and that's probably it's probably why it's important to think about your investments a little bit harder, especially for companies that looks to be undervalued.
Could you say something about the companies that you're overweight in, about your largest holdings in the fund?
So in the strategy now, on a country level, maybe this is just to remind, we talked a little bit about that, but Asian frontier markets are doing well, Middle Eastern frontier markets, Eastern European frontier markets are also doing quite well. Type of companies, we like, first of all, fast growing. So our investment case, what is that? If you invest in frontier markets, you are betting on young populations, fast economic growth, stable economic growth, structural growth. Structural growth is different than cyclical growth, right? If you have, for instance, a grocery retail, think about, I don't know if you can name names, but ICAS or Coops here, think about that. They would be commanding to the large part of, you know, grocery market. People would be going there. It's structured, organized retail, it's called, right? If you go to a frontier market like Vietnam, organized retail is nothing. It's just 10-20% of the market. And it's a very long process to go from unorganized to organized. So we like that. That's what we call a structural growth story. Morocco, it's the same. We have a similar dynamic there. And we have the Carrefour of Morocco, for instance, that we have been investing for many, many years. But that's type of growth we are looking for in the companies that we invest in. It could be a structural growth in healthcare, in food retail, in education. If you look at the UAE now, where I've been based in since 2016, we are seeing more and more schools being opened. Population is growing very fast. It's a very different type of place. You don't have organic population growth. You have people moving in. You don't have anywhere in the world this kind of population growth dynamics. The population of the city has grown from 2.4 million to 3.5 million over the last 8 years during my time. That's 40-50% growth. That's massive. So if you have that kind of growth, then you are building more schools, you are building more hospitals. That's your structural growth along with population growth. That's happening also in the Philippines. That's happening in Morocco. or Egypt. So we like that kind of structural growth. Or we have IT companies in different parts of the world. We have a Vietnamese IT company. We have a Pakistani IT company. They are growing by 20-25% in terms of revenues. The Vietnamese company that we are investing in has been delivering 20-22% annual revenue growth. Imagine the compounding effect of that kind of growth. And annual equity returns has been 28% in US dollar terms over the last 10 years. That's significant growth if you also think about the compounding effect. Mm. So we have a mix of fast-growing companies as such, benefiting from structural growth. It could be digitalization processes in the IT business, or it could be different legs of it. But on top of that, you have real estate. We like recurring revenues as opposed to cyclical real estate. Or we have banks that are delivering in excess of 20% return on equity. It will sound a bit too technical, but think about a bank with 100 million something unit equity. In Europe, you would be delivering 8 to 12% on that equity. Of course, admittedly, it's a low interest rate environment, but in many of these markets, you are delivering 20, 30% return on equity. And think about compounding that equity over the next 5-10 years, growing your loan book by 15-20% instead of 3-5% in a developed market. So this makes a big difference. So what I'm trying to say, in terms of, maybe without going too much into individual companies, the idea here is to invest in fast growing companies, but fast growing companies which benefit from structural growth, not cyclical growth. We are not investing too much in mining companies. Mining companies may have a fantastic year, 80% growth 1 year, but then all of a sudden commodity prices are coming down, then the whole growth is gone. So we like to see, I think the best investments typically, at least when I think about my almost 20 years of investing, it's partly a joke, but the best investments have been in the companies that I know the least about. Because if you have structural growth, you don't need to know all the details on a monthly or quarterly basis. If you invest in a food retail company in Morocco, you know that organized food retail is a very small part of the market. You know that they are opening 100 new stores or 300 new stores. You can easily take all the numbers together. You look for structural growth, and you don't need to know if they have a good quarter or good month, or margins are shrinking a bit or growing a little bit going forward. It's just structural growth, and you grow with it.
Do you always visit the companies that you invest in?
We do. We either physically visit, and that's our preference, or sometimes we don't have the opportunity. We are traveling a lot. Then we make sure that we have calls with companies. I think from this perspective, initially COVID looked pretty bad for everyone. We weren't able to travel, but it was a bit of a game changer for us in a positive way. Because before COVID, companies were less open to interact with investors, especially in frontier markets, because these financial markets are still in early stages. And sometimes it happened to me quite a few times that you arrange a call with the management of the company for an update, investor relations, or at a high level CEO, CFO, board level. You want to have some color of the business, have some business update. But we had a few cases when companies were thinking that we wanted to take over their company, not like financial investors, but they thought if we are buying the whole thing, and sometimes they are a bit less open to foreigners because they think there is some hostile foreigner trying to take over the company in some cases, in a few cases. But after COVID, I think it became more of a default procedure, because in the past we would try to arrange phone calls if we couldn't visit the company. They wouldn't be very open, or phone line would be pretty bad. But after COVID, we have video calls. Of course, we like to go to companies, we meet with them, we shake hands and everything. But after COVID, we are having a bit more of these calls, because if my next Vietnamese trip is in 6 months' time, I don't want to wait for that. I want to have these calls on a regular basis every now and then. So we have different ways of, let's say, interacting with companies, and that includes both physical meetings and virtual meetings.
Has it happened that you found a company that was you think is really interesting, and then you visit it, and then you find something that isn't that good?
That's I can give you a few examples. I have seen companies, you go to their headquarters, and for instance, this was some years ago, a company with so much of paperwork on the desks. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't expect an innovative company to have all these papers piled up on top of each other.
Mm.
That's a bit contradictory to what you would be thinking.
Mm.
Or you would like to see, of course, the food retail company, or we have been visiting a gym operator. You want to see the quality. You need to kick the, as the expression goes, the tires.
The tires, yeah. Mm.
But I also don't believe in anecdotal evidence.
Mm.
That's important. That's part of storytelling. Let's be honest. Everyone likes to talk about that. If you talk to any portfolio manager, they'll be telling you they met with the owner, they went to the store. I think it's a reality check. That's important. But if anecdotes start overriding data, I like my data. I like to collect data. We like to look at financials. We like to look at balance sheets and everything. We like to double check with peers of that company, because you might get different and sometimes inconsistent views about that. But it doesn't work. I mean, anecdotes are important, but yeah, okay, I went to Egypt and it was so lively. People were on the streets, they were consuming.
Mm.
But you can't build a sustainable investment case only by looking at that. You need to know what you're doing. You need to be on the ground. You need to understand what's happening. I'm not denying the importance of that.
Mm.
But I think we need to rely on different channels or on different evidence. It should be consistent with each other, because it's not only about that. And one example is, I mean, it's the other way maybe. Let's take Turkey. Okay, it's easier to talk about Turkey, and it's a quite interesting market.
It's a very interesting market, yeah. Mm.
If you would think about this market and look at the headlines or anecdotal evidence, you would think, okay, inflation is booming. It's crazy inflation, actually. You know, it was peaking at 80-85%. Nowadays, still 70-something or 60-something percent. If you look at Financial Times on the first page, you see that the economy is collapsing. Everything is looking really bad. But in 2022, world's best performing market by far in US dollar terms, not in lira terms, was Turkey with 117% return in US dollars.
Incredible. Yeah.
Argentina, this year's best performer, 50%. Last year's, I think it ended the year as the best performer as well. But what I'm trying to say is that if you think about your feelings or anecdotes or the first page of Financial Times, you might get a different view. Both, you might have a positive view and the market is collapsing, or you might have a negative view, but the market is rallying significantly. So we need to be really realistic, pragmatic. And what's also more important, and that goes back to investment criteria and investment philosophy, we always have to, I mean, as individual investors as well, focus on risk return profile. Because you can talk about so many risks, currency risk, political risk, geopolitical risk, I don't know, all sorts of risks, business risk. But if the risk return profile is favorable, what do I mean? If the valuations are at a level that it becomes almost like a no-brainer type of valuation, then you look at it, okay, the most at this level, you know, stock is already down by 50%, let's say, I can possibly lose 10, 20, even 30% at this level. But if things go in the right direction, the stock can go up by 3 times, 5 times. You have some cases, or downside is 10%, upside is 30%. So we are looking for this kind of asymmetrical risk return profile, because we need to take certain risks. We sometimes don't even know the risks that we are taking as investors in general, but we are here to take some risks. But the most important point here is to take the right profile of risk return to maximize your, you know, consistent and long-term returns.
Okay, looking ahead, what are the major milestones you anticipate for frontier markets in the coming years?
There's no one answer there, because as I mentioned, we are following 20 plus markets, maybe close to 30 markets across the globe, all different dynamics. But I think the short term focus should be on these economic recovery stories, rebalancing stories, and you have also some markets that are already doing well. And I think cycles, when they start, they might go a little bit longer than you expect. in the US, we are seeing this endless cycle. That's a bit of an exception, perhaps, but that cycle has been going on for longer than expected. Now, for many frontier markets, we'll be seeing economic growth picking up or continuing at a high level. Eventually, with inflation easing in frontier markets as well, we'll be seeing more and more interest rate cuts. It will be very interesting to see if and when, I think it's more of a matter of when than if the US dollar is weakening again, because it's been too strong for too long. Rates have been too high for too long in the US, but there'll be a turning point there as well. And then we'll be seeing not only about frontier markets, but also in the emerging markets as well. We'll be seeing a positive cycle and self-fulfilling positive cycle, because once you accelerate your economy, consumption growth that fits into economy production growth, you know how it works with the cycles, and these cycles can go longer than expected. I think this is what we are going to see in the coming years, and over time we'll not realize it, but we'll see financial markets, capital markets deepening. We are seeing significant developments in the Middle East, especially in Saudi Arabia. The first time I visited Saudi Arabia was 10 years ago. I spent 10 years in that market, but 10, you know, human regular years. But in reality, it's been more like 50 years of development since I first visited Saudi Arabia, with all the reforms that they are implementing. There'll be bumps on the road. It's never a straightforward case. But we'll see these kind of developments in many of frontier markets. And the next step, next maybe, if you call it a milestone, that we'll be seeing will be that some of these frontier markets will be included into emerging markets indices over time. We have seen it happening with Qatar and the UAE back in 2014. We have seen it with Pakistan graduating into emerging markets and coming down again. We have seen it with Argentina. We saw it with Kuwait. We might see it imminently with Vietnam in the next 1 or 2 years. We might see it with Romania. But eventually, if these markets are continuing to go in the right direction, they should be included in different indices, widely followed indices, and that should be, again, a positive self-fulfilling prophecy. As they develop, there'll be more interest. As there is more interest, they are included into indices, and there's even more interest. So I think in the bigger scope of things, there'll be bumps on the road, but I think the general direction for these markets should be positive in the next 5 to 10 years.
Emre, thank you very much for coming to Placera.
Thank you. My pleasure.